This is gonna hurt. It's time for the Suffering Podcast.
The vision of our lives is often calm seas, sunshine, rainbows, and a straight path to success. Believing in our hearts that any obstacle in our path will be easily traversed, we do our work to ensure that we have every opportunity to win at the game of life. When the storm hits, it will usually start as a light drizzle, replacing the sunshine only moments earlier. Before we know it, the waves are crashing over the bow and we are out of control. Chaos ensues, and the only hope is to survive. If we can weather the storm, often there is a hidden rainbow at the end. We're better prepared on our road to success. The only true preparation for life is gained by experience. I'm Kevin Donaldson here with Mike Felice, and on this episode of the Suffering Podcast, we welcome Nick Ricchetti to discuss the suffering of substance abuse. Nick knows all too well about the path that addiction and overindulgence can take you. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Absolutely, guys. Thank you for having me.
I'm just surprised you got his name right. That was a first shot, too.
I am having the hardest time in this studio because we have an influx of Italian names coming in.
Because they're all from Hoboken, mainly.
They're like a mile long, and they don't make sense in the English language.
You got the double C, the double T. Throws everything off.
Thanks so much for coming in. I've seen you speak. We run in somewhat of the same circles. Yep. And you got a fantastic story. Everybody's really in for a treat tonight.
Thank you.
But before we go any further, we take a social media question every week. This one comes from Amanda143, and it says, "If your life had a theme song, what would it be?" And the way that I took this, let's say you were a WWE superstar and you're walking out of the tunnel, what song plays in the background?
So the first song that comes to head is a song by Eminem, and it's called 25 to Life. And it's pretty much about how he dedicates his life to hip hop. And at the end, they're just like, fuck you. You know, so that's kind of, I dedicated six years of my life to law enforcement. And at the end of it, it was just like a see you later.
Yeah. You know, Eminem's one of those artists, and I like some Eminem songs, but he's always so damn angry. It just seems very exhausting.
Oh, yeah.
It's just, like, come on. You can crack a smile. It's okay, man. It's
yeah, he's
okay.
He's a little serious.
He really is. And I just, it's real tough.
Especially in his like earlier music, too.
But you do Without Me with Dr. Dre, and that was sort of goofy. The video was goofy. So, what's the problem?
He's had a couple of goofy ones.
Yeah, I don't know. He just, every time you see him, he's got that serious bitch face on, and I don't know what it is. Mike, what do you think? He's checking his watch. Just so you know, we try to curb the cursing early on in the show, but go ahead.
All right. I got two songs that I could use. One, you're going to love. My Way by Frank Sinatra.
Yeah, but you're not walking out to a tunnel my way. You're going to put the crowd to sleep.
All right. Then I'm going to pick Fuck You by Overkill.
It's a wonderful lyrical name.
Yes, it is. It's a fantastic song. It just don't care about anything.
They weave a fabric of lyrics.
Says, we don't care what you say, fuck you. And that's the way I live my life. I don't care what you say about me. Yep. You like me, you don't.
That's it.
I got enough friends.
You know, if it wasn't walking out of a tunnel, my life lyrically would be The Gambler by Kenny Rogers. Yeah. You know, know when to hold him and know when to fold him. And there's plenty of times when I should have folded and I just stayed in and went all in. But if I was walking out of a tunnel and there was a theme song, do you ever hear the song Wood by Alice in Chains?
No.
Yeah. It's got a real low beat in the beginning, and it sort of builds in a crescendo. And, you know, it's about a guy who's, the first line is know me broken by my master. And, you know, I got broken down in my life, but, you know, at the end, if you would, could you? You basically come back up. So, you know, that would be my song that I would march out to. But then there's always the fan favorites, you know, Thunderstruck or
you're right.
Welcome to the Jungle.
Hell's Bells,
Ride the Lightning.
Or actually, Accept has a song called Balls to the Wall.
But then there was
that's another way. Live life, balls to the wall.
But then there was the Disturb song, that which we were talking about earlier.
Down with the Sickness.
Down with the Sickness. I mean, you listen to that song.
Oh, man.
I just want to go work out. That's all I want to do. So Amanda 143, thank you so much for sending that in, and keep sending in your questions and we will try to get them on the air. But before we go any further, let's give a big shout out to our marquee sponsor, and that's Toyota of Hackensack. We don't trust anybody, but we do trust them. So if you're looking for a car, go to toyotahackensack.com. Let them find you a car. The guys over there are real good.
My father's
got your father's car.
I need a new car soon.
You know, Toyota Hackensack.
Toyota Hackensack.
Go over see Freddie.
I'll check out Freddie.
Just tell him we sent you, and you know, so they can continue their sponsorship with us. Right?
Sounds good.
And you notice nobody said any Elvis Presley songs in that whole thing. I'm just saying.
Listen, we could go suspicious. Hey, you know, yes. Okay, I'm going to go back to Elvis. So I was in a chase once. And I had the radio on. I forget what station it was, but Burning Love comes on. If you have never been in a police chase and just listen to Burning Love, you're going 75 miles an hour.
Right.
You're going 75 miles an hour and Burning Love's playing. I'm telling you what, your adrenaline's going through the roof.
How about Highway Star?
Highway
Star. You're my highway star.
Why don't you have Neil Diamond playing during chase? That's what you guys listen to in Lyndhurst, right? So, Nick, you travel. You didn't travel that far. You're a local guy. You know, it's always nice to see a familiar face in here. I know enough about you because I've seen you speak, and you know we've talked at length. Why don't you tell our audience a little bit about yourself?
Sure. So, I grew up in Morris County. Grew up in Mount Arlington. Went to Roxbury school system. Growing up, normal childhood, normal family. I have a sister. Parents are still together. Pretty nucleus family. I was an athlete growing up. I played baseball and basketball in high school until I started thinking about going to college. I wanted to play baseball in college, so my senior year I cut out the basketball, started focusing just on baseball, and I ended up getting a scholarship to a Division II baseball school. So I went to college to play baseball.
What school?
Chestnut Hill College.
That one.
Down in Philadelphia.
Okay.
Down your neck of the woods.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
So they were a startup program. So I went down there figuring it was going to be my best shot to play.
Division II. Hey, listen, they pay for your college. That's the main thing.
Yep. I did get some money to go play. And then they threw me some other wishy-wash grants and stuff like that. So I went down there. I played for 2 years. Going into my junior year, I dislocate my shoulder right before the season. And then I kind of call it quits. I really wasn't like in love with playing baseball anymore at that point. I more wanted to focus on like experience in college. So,
when you go to college on a scholarship though, you're a slave to them.
Yeah, you know? I mean, so my high school baseball coach did like a really good job of preparing like the guys that went and played college baseball for what like college baseball would be like, minus obviously the living out on your own aspect.
Yeah,
but in terms of like what practices were going to be like and the discipline and what it was going to require to succeed, like he did a really good job. So like when I went and played. Like nothing that was like brand new to me in terms of like what was expected from me as an athlete.
Well, I remember when I got done playing in college, when I got done playing football was like a task. It was no longer fun to me. And when I was done.
Right.
And I just didn't want to play no more. And I look back, you know, I'm 48 years old now. I look back at that 21-year-old kid and go, dude, you're so stupid. Because I'd give anything just to play one more day.
Agreed.
I can't.
I always say that. I said, give me one more series in football.
Yep.
Just one more.
And carry me off the field.
Yeah. And when I quit, my dad told me, like, you're going to regret it. Don't do it. And I'm like, no, I'm done. I'm good. And you look back now and I'm like, I wish I stayed.
Yeah.
Now you're playing in softball leagues.
Yeah. You're just yeah. So
reliving the glory years.
Yeah. Well, I ended up coaching. Once I graduated college, I ended up coaching. So, like, I majored in criminal justice. When I went into college, I wasn't sure exactly, like, what I wanted to do. So I went in undeclared, and eventually I had to declare, and I knew that I was awful at math, so I didn't want to take any math classes, so this is literally how I picked a major, is I like went through and saw like what can I test out of math and not have to take a math class. Criminal justice was one of them, so I just declared criminal justice based off that.
Now, did you find a love for the criminal justice field, or was that just a means to an end?
It was like a means to an end in school. I mean, some of the courses like were interesting, but for the most part, it was just to try and honestly pick like an easy degree.
How fast can I get out of here?
How fast can I get out? Yeah, like what is going to be like the less like time consuming degree for me to pursue?
The only class I took in college that was criminal justice degree related was political science, and that was in the criminal justice field.
Right,
but that was a fun class because I'm going to explain to you why I had to write a paper on a law that I disagreed with. And one of them was the legalization of marijuana. I do not agree with the legalization of marijuana. I just I know I'm gonna make enemies saying that, but I don't. But I had to write a paper on it,
right.
And then I started doing research on it, and I was like, holy shit! You know, they got some valid points
right.
for it. You know, the recidivism rate of people arrested for marijuana is so low, it's almost non-existent. You know,
yeah.
once they do their time, they get out, they're done. Things like that, and then the damage it does to your body. So I learned a lot. It didn't really change my stance, but what it did is it gave me a healthy understanding of the opposing view. And that's what it was designed to do, obviously.
Right. Well, that's what life's all about, is knowing both sides of each story.
Right.
You know, and then
right.
trying to meet in the middle.
Right. And that's what some of those classes entail. There's like healthy debates on, you know, yeah. important issues, important topics.
Yeah.
So.
Well, isn't that what life is? Just opening up a healthy debate.
That's
you,
it.
You get so jaded. You get an idea. You get so jaded and you don't want to hear the other side of the story. Once you hear the other side of the story, like I said, you know, you were against it and you heard the other side. It's like,
yeah. Well, that's where the issue comes, is people don't want to hear the other side of the story.
Yeah, exactly.
Because they're afraid. You know, I think a lot of it comes from they're afraid their points are going to be proven wrong.
Yeah.
You know, they become married to their opinions. And I think that's dangerous for anybody. But so criminal justice, when you got out, you finally graduated?
So I graduated in 4 years. My two guys who used to coach me when I was in high school, they opened up their own baseball facility. So I was friends with them, so they hired me. I went. I coached with them. I ran the facility until I was looking to find a job in criminal justice. You know, I was looking to be a cop. So I took the civil service test. When I graduated college in 2011, like, it was that point where, like, 2009, 10, 11, like, it really wasn't the best time to get hired as a cop. Like, people were laying off. Guys were going on the rice list from civil service.
Oh, God, I remember that rice list. I was high enough up on the seniority where I'm like,
yeah. God. Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah. So it took me 3 years to find a job. I graduated in 11, and I ended up getting hired in 2014 with the Morris County Sheriff's Office in the jail.
Did you go alternate? They make you go alternate route?
No. So I didn't. I applied to try to get in an alternate route program, but I never got in. So I took the civil service test and I checked like corrections and law enforcement. And I ended up getting a call from the Morris County Sheriff's Office for the Corrections Bureau.
Yeah.
So I took that as like a stepping stone to try and get, you know.
You at least get a PTC number.
Yeah, exactly.
No, you don't get it as corrections. You don't?
So in New Jersey, first off, you start working in the jail before you go to the academy. So I never actually went to the academy for the jail because I ended up getting hired by like the upfront Morris County Sheriff's Office, just the law enforcement bureau.
Yeah.
The same time I was going to get to the corrections academy.
That's a beautiful thing.
Yeah. Well, and your PTC number for corrections doesn't transfer it over to law enforcement.
You got to take the 2 weeks of 2C.
You got to take the whole academy.
Really?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, I thought you had.
That's how they do it in Bergen County. You get hired as a CO, you got to take an in-service or in-house civil service test, and then they got to put you through the whole police academy.
Yeah, there's no waiver for COs over to law enforcement.
See, I want
to. There was that for a little while in Bergen County.
Yeah.
Where you only had to take the couple courses.
That's what I think I thought.
It's 2C and Title 39.
Title 39, yeah. You would think, but no, you got to take the whole thing over again.
And domestic violence.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, it's good that you got hired. And then, so you get on, I'm assuming you're ecstatic.
So, yes and no. So, for the sheriff's office, the only reason why I left the jail, like, when I was working in the jail, I legitimately, like, I liked it. I got along with all my supervisors. I got along with the guys who I was working with. I didn't have a problem working with inmates. Like I said, I legitimately liked it, but it wasn't, like, the ultimate goal. Like, I didn't, you know, when I went to school and decided I was going to be a cop, I didn't want to be a CO. I wanted to, like, be on the street. I wanted to be a real cop, quote, unquote. So, I took the PTC in hopes to just get like hired on a real department, not on like a municipal town.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, where you'd be out, you're doing stops, all that kind of stuff, answering DV calls. So that's why I decided to go up front and leave the jail, is because I thought it better my chance. I was wrong because I wasn't able to transfer out. So I had like one offer to transfer out when I got hired up front. Scotch Plains offered me a job, but it was just too far from where I was working and or from where I was living. Personal situations with my girlfriend at the time, it just wasn't going to work out, so I turned it down. So in 2000, I got hired in the jail in 2014. In 2016, I leave the jail, I go up front. And that's where like I did my career there. You know, I did 4 years up front.
And you got stuck in the courts?
So I started in the courts.
Been there, done that. I started a Bergen County Sheriff's Department.
Yeah, and that's part of the
court security.
Yeah, that's how everything kind of goes downhill. It's not having a purpose. So, like, I started in the courts, and I had, like, these high hopes, these big visions of getting out of courts, like, right away. And it just, like, did not happen. So I did probably 2 years-ish or so, 2.5 years maybe, in courts until I was able to transfer out. I went over to Warrens for a little bit, and then got myself in a lot of trouble over there, off duty, nothing on duty, everything off duty, get transferred back into courts, and then the whole career kind of shuts down there.
Did you have, like, child support warrants and violation probation warrants? Or
Yeah. So that's what we were doing, like, post-conviction.
Yeah.
So what kind of trouble off duty did you get into?
So my vices were alcohol and painkillers. And my drinking, like, when I was in college and stuff like that, like, yeah, I drank, you know, I binge drank just like most college kids do. You know, I went on spring break for 4 days, like, binge drink down there. Mm-hmm. But it was never really an issue. It never really affected my life. Even when I was working in the jail, we'd go out after shift because, you know, you have off days, like, compared to, like, your normal friends who are working 9-to-5s. So you go out on shift during the week, you go out, you drink, and it was never really an issue, especially because I had, like, purpose and I legitimately liked work. So my drinking starts intensifying, getting worse and worse when I go up front because I'm so bored and I feel like I have no purpose for that time period that I'm working in courts. And to make matters worse, I was just spending a lot of time alone. So for me, like, I always hated being alone. I still don't like being alone. I'm better at it now. So, like, one thing that I've worked on is being okay alone, but I couldn't stand it at the time. So what do you do when you're bored alone and all your friends don't want to go out because they work normal jobs? Like, you call other cops that have days off similar to you and you go out. Mm-hmm. And that's what I did.
And where do you go?
To the bar.
Right to the bar.
To the bar.
What did we used to do after group therapy?
Yeah, we went to a bar.
We went to a bar.
Yep.
Some of us would just eat, and some of us would just drink. Eating anything? No.
I ruined it for everybody. I wasn't allowed to drink.
Yeah.
Because rehab did not suit me well. I did not like it. So, now, out of 7 days, how many of those days were you drinking?
It varied. Yeah. So I would binge, and I would go on, like, tears where I would drink, like, 3, 4, sometimes 5 days in a row. And then, like, something would happen. I would piss somebody off, somebody close to me, my girlfriend at the time. I would, like, kind of see the light, and I would stop for a little bit.
Stop for 3 days and say, okay, I'm okay, I could stop.
So the breaks were longer than that. But then, like, my friends would hit me up who I was going out and drinking with, all cops, and I would go out with them again.
Because then, you, like, think that you have this moment of clarity. This sobriety. You're like, this ain't a problem. I got this big. I got this beat. This is not a big deal.
I got it. This time I promise it's going to be different.
Yeah.
You know, and, like, the longer breaks came, like, when I would get myself in trouble off duty. Because when you're going out drinking with your friends to the bar, like, how do you get home?
Yeah, you drive.
You're going to drive home, you know? So
you're going to have another drunken cop drive you home.
Yeah. Either way, it's not a safe situation for anybody. So that's what I did. Like, I was drinking and driving a lot. Like, when I was drinking, nobody could take my keys. Like, people tried. Like, you were not going to take my keys. I was going to drink and I was going to drive home because I'm a big boy. I can take care of myself. And on top of that, like, there started becoming, like, an adrenaline, like, risk factor with the drinking and driving.
I can see that.
Yeah.
But, you know, having the brass pass doesn't help.
No.
Yeah, because.
No.
Badge AmeriCard.
How many times were you caught?
Define caught.
Or pulled
stopped
over.
Stopped.
Yeah.
And let go.
So there's three, like, big ones.
Yeah. Support for the Suffering Podcast is brought to you by Manscaped, who's the best in men's below-the-waist grooming.
Their products are precision-engineered tools for your family jewels. Manscaped Performance Package is the ultimate men's hygiene bundle.
Inside the package, you'll find the Lawnmower 4.0, Weed Whacker Ear Nose Hair Trimmer, and the Crop Preserver Ball Deodorant.
And we also got the Crop Reviver Ball Toner. This thing is a life changer. Along with that,
Boxer briefs?
I'm going to tell you what. These are like high quality boxer briefs. And this is no joke. I'm not saying this just because really Manscaped sent it to us. These are nice. My boys are going to be quite happy in there.
And you can't tell Kevin's wearing them under the table right now. And we also have a nice travel package.
Join over 8 million men worldwide who trust Manscaped with this exclusive offer just for you. 20% off and free worldwide shipping with the code TSP at manscaped.com.
Jesus Christ, that's a lot of balls.
There's probably, just off the top of my head, 6 DUIs. Mm-hmm. So like the 3 smaller ones were like, yeah, maybe had too many. See you later. The 3 bigger ones were like, the first one, I was like cooperative. I was respectful. I was grateful. The guy did me a solid. He ends up driving me home. The next 2, I should have been put in cuffs. Like, absolutely. There's 0 doubt about it. Like, the fact that the guys who were involved with my last 2 pullovers getting drunk, like, blow my mind. And I'm, like, so grateful to this day that they didn't put me in cuffs.
Yeah. That was always the tough thing. There was a bunch of people who used to drive through our town that were cops. They lived in an adjacent town. And they were always drinking. Yep. Always drunk. And most of the time, you'd see them flying around the corner. You pull them over. You recognize them. You're like, yeah, you know what? I think your car's smoking. I think, you know, your car's overheating. Why don't you pull it in here and I'll give you a ride home.
Right.
I'd rather give you a ride home. But there was one of the siblings who gave us a hard time. And I remember asking him. I remember looking him right in the eye. I go, bro, you really want to do this? Because my job's more important than yours. Yeah. You know, that's what it comes down to. I'm going to try my best to protect you. I'm going to try my best to do what I can. It's professional courtesy. Right. I don't find anything wrong with it. It's a safety issue. But don't give me a bag of shit, dude.
I always say it's me or you, and it ain't going to be me.
Yeah. I'm with you. And I say that I'm grateful, and I am, like, incredibly grateful. Don't get me wrong. But there is, like, this side of me that has always thought, like, what if that first guy wrote me? You get a DUI, like, as a cop, like, are you going to lose your job? In my department, no, because we were averaging like a DUI a year when I was there.
Okay. Well, yeah, there's other opportunities in there for DUIs.
Yeah. So like you get a DUI, am I going to lose my job? No. Am I going to be on the shit list for a while? Yeah. I'll work out of it.
Yeah.
You know, same thing the second time. That guy gave me that DUI. Like, would things have been different? Would my career have gone down the drain like it did? Maybe, maybe not. You know, these are all like just big what ifs.
Yeah, exactly.
But they're valid questions, like if you're a cop, to ask yourself, like, because you think that you're doing that guy a solid by like, all right, let me help this guy out. But are you enabling him?
Yeah, exactly.
Are you enabling him to go do the same thing over and over again like I was?
That's a good perspective on it because you're actually emboldening his ability. Yeah. Look, I got away with it once. I'm going to do it again.
And that's what happened to me. Like, if you look at like my off-duty incidences, they just got worse and worse and worse. Mm-hmm. You know, everything just started to escalate. Just like my drinking was escalating, my off-duty incidents were escalating. You know,
the more you drink, the worse your decisions get too.
Oh yeah.
Did anybody in your department recognize this downward spiral?
I had one person asked me, like, so after the second off-duty incident that I had one person
with drinking, obviously.
Yeah. Right? Every off-duty incident that I had was with drinking. And so, like, I don't know if I said, like, my vices were alcohol and painkillers. My big, like, issue was alcohol. I was drinking way more than I was messing around with painkillers, not to downplay the painkillers, but the alcohol was like a root of like a lot of my issues. And the painkillers like came. So the guys that I ended up getting jammed up with, like cocaine.
Okay. Smells good.
So for me, like, cocaine never did anything for me. Like, it brought me down. It didn't bring me up. But what brought me up was painkillers for whatever chemical reason my brain and my body work.
They had the reverse on me.
Yeah.
And that's why I could never – I can understand how people get addicted to painkillers.
Yeah.
But as far as like a – because of the feeling, but as far as a recreational drug, I always thought it was a shitty recreational drug because you take it and you just veg out. That's what it was me.
Yeah. So for me, it brought me up. Like, for whatever, like I said, chemical going on in my body, like, it brought me up. And like the same thing, like – because, like, obviously you're in law enforcement, you know the dangers of painkillers and opiates and how addictive they are and how quick things can go downhill really fast. That sounds so screwed up to say, but like, I was good on like drawing that line, would walk the line, and then I'd be like, all right, I got to stop. And I would stop for a while, and then it was the same thing with the drinking. Then I would go back to everything.
As Charlie Murphy said, you were a habitual line stepper.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's a good way to put it. Yeah.
You ever see that when he talks about Rick James?
Yeah.
Rick James was a habitual
line stepper. Yeah.
Now, did you ever go, were painkillers, we'll get into the painkiller side, yeah. Were painkillers a daily use?
No, not even close.
And did you ever go to work on the painkillers?
No.
No. So it was purely recreational.
They were all recreational.
Did you ever go to work on alcohol?
That's a
the
true. Think,
so the maybe, thinking maybe about it is over, yes. So
hung over at least anyway. I mean,
yeah, I mean, yeah.
Yeah.
Like I spent a lot of time on call. Okay. So like for like we would do like transports for municipalities where like you're an Uber for the town. Yeah. You go up, you pick up the prisoner, you bring him to jail. Two person job. So like if I was drinking, I obviously like wouldn't drive and the guy, my partner would drive.
Now, what was a normal night for you as far as drinking goes? Quantities.
Yeah. So I can't drink a lot. Even when when I was drinking, like I couldn't drink a lot. So like my go-tos were like Jameson and Blue Moon, you know? So like pretty much just alternate like a shot of Jameson and a shot of Blue and a Blue Moon. And like, that's what I was doing. How many, like anywhere from like four in one sitting, like the shop right in my town had a bar. So like when I would go to ShopRite to go food shopping, I would go to the bar and I would get like a shot of Jameson and a Blue Moon. And then before I left, I'd go get a shot of Jameson and a Blue Moon.
Okay.
You know,
shopping.
Like, that's normal.
That would shopping. Be like I always said you should have a laundromat with a like a bar right like next to it, you know?
Fortune.
You make a killing.
You make a fortune. Yeah. The only thing more boring than sitting at a laundromat is sitting in a court.
Yeah, that's facts. Trust me. So, yeah. And then, like, when we would go out, like, with my friends, like, we would go out, like, after, you know, work, and that time varied, but we'd go out to a bar, and then we'd end up going back to somebody's house and keep drinking, and depending on what I had going on at home or whatever the next day, I would either stay there or I would drive home at 2 o'clock in the morning, whatever it was.
And that was the normal life.
That was normal life, yeah. And then, like I said, something bad would happen, and I would stop, and I would be a good boy, and then the cycle, the insanity cycle just continues and continues until it had to stop.
You know,
you know how crazy it is, how crazy it gets? I don't know if it's just law enforcement, but when we used to work a midnight shift, you know, we worked Pittman schedule. So right. We worked, you know, seven at night to seven in the morning.
Right.
Our last midnight shift in, we'd call the surrounding towns. There was a bar that opened at 7 o'clock in the morning. After your last midnight shift in, we'd go sit at the bar at 7 o'clock in the morning.
Yep.
Have a couple drinks, get a couple pizzas.
I don't know, man. See, that's the one thing I never really was heavily involved in while I was working. I was never I don't do well on hangovers. So okay. That's really but one of the things that saved me.
That's where you justify it. It's your last shift in.
Yeah.
So you got a couple days off.
Yeah.
You know, it's all justifying it in your mind.
You can justify pretty much anything.
Anything you want to do, you can justify it.
Yep. And you know, in your mind you're doing everything right, but did you feel that your job was in jeopardy?
No, even after, so the last off-duty incident that I had was like bad. Like I was out at a bar. I didn't even make it to my car because the cops from the town ended up getting called prior to that. I don't even remember why. And then I just pretty much tried to fight like a whole like squad of like midnight shift guys. Like I don't remember anything from it. Like I don't remember details, but like in my IA, they were like showing me stills and they were like reading me like clips from like the audio. And it was like really, really bad. Like they should have locked me up, but they gave me, I wasn't able to call somebody who I worked with and they came and picked me up. But even like after that incident, I didn't think my job was in jeopardy. I thought this is where like, I kind of start thinking like before that off duty incident happens and like during it, obviously. I kind of start thinking that like I have an issue now. Like now maybe I don't have this under control. Cause like I said, like I found out like it was like bad. Like I'm not even going to repeat some of the stuff that they said I told these guys to do. So I like inquire briefly about like what is like the help option. And they're like, go to Florida, you know, down to Florida House.
Florida House.
Yeah. So I'm like, well, I'm not going down to Florida. Like what else is there? And he's like, nothing. You have to go to Florida. And I was like, all right, scratch that. So like the idea came and went because I was just told like, you have to go to Florida. So, but in terms of like somebody from my department, like coming up to me and being like, hey, like we heard about this, like you need help. None of that. Like it didn't, you know, even like my IA for that incident was just like a ass ripping, like the lieutenant for the IA, like ripped me so hard. My sheriff, my under sheriff, some chief of staff guy in a gig spot, like ripped me because I requested a meeting with them after like the whole IA was done.
Rockford.
No, Gannon. He's a sheriff now. Yeah. I requested a meeting with them to like apologize for like putting such a shitty look on the department. And I didn't get a chance to do that. Like I just walked in there and they just like ripped me like for a solid like 20 minutes. But like at no point was the question like, what is wrong with you? Like why? Like how do you get to this level?
How do you get to this point?
Yeah.
You know, the question was posed to me recently. It's we see a cop get into a DWI or get locked up for something stupid. And we look at, God, what a bonehead, what a big mistake. But nobody is ever really looking at, okay, but why is he drinking? Because one of the things that I learned in rehab is alcoholics do not become cops. Cops become alcoholics.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
So nobody ever looked at the reason why. Is there, do you, if you could pull something out why you were drinking, is it just the loneliness?
The loneliness, like I said, the adrenaline that I was getting from it, the camaraderie aspect of it as well. Like I became,
that's a major thing.
I became close with like, you know, five of us got arrested. Like all five of those guys, like I was close with,
yeah.
You know, there's the camaraderie aspect of it. Literally every function in law enforcement revolves around drinking. You go to someone's wake, funeral, whatever, you're going to go drinking after it. Somebody retires, even if the retirement party is at 7 a.m., guys are going to go there and they're going to drink.
Every,
you know what I mean?
Every cop movie, for people who aren't in law enforcement, every cop movie has a scene in it around a bar, which by the way, the best bar scene in any cop movie is the other guys. That's the best cop scene in a bar ever.
That was a desk pop too, right? No. The other guy. You ever do a desk pop?
fun with screwing with rookies. Yeah.
But the funny thing is, like you said, the camaraderie issue. If the whole squad's going out and one guy doesn't go,
you're square.
You're talking about that guy the whole time.
You're talking about him and you don't trust, like, you don't trust him.
You don't trust
him. I didn't trust
him. If he doesn't want to come out drinking with us, I don't trust him.
Don't trust you. Yep.
100%.
I've heard that before. I guess that's why not a lot of people trust me.
And not for nothing, like.
That's why we don't hang out.
in my circle too, like, if you were like straight, like, we didn't trust you. And it went more than like drinking. You know what I mean?
So.
Like, there were more cops that got jammed up that were like messing around with shit than like anybody knows about.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. You know,
like, there's no secret that, like, cops aren't these, like, angels.
No, we're human beings.
Absolutely.
We're human beings just like everybody else.
And cops are just as susceptible to fall into addiction with drugs and alcohol than anybody. Absolutely more.
Yeah.
Statistically more, yes.
Yes. So.
Well, because of the things we see on a daily basis.
That you're not supposed to see.
Yeah.
And that you don't have time to process either.
Because you got
to
move on to the next call.
Yeah.
You know, when you're in the courts and in the jails, you're seeing, like, we see them at the absolute worst, and then you see them when they're dealing with the consequences.
Right.
And you see when people's lives get really broken and destroyed.
Yep.
And I don't care who you are. You could be the strongest person in the world. That's going to affect you somehow.
Absolutely.
So how bad did it get?
So the drinking and the drugs?
Yeah. Where were you getting your pills from, by the way? Because at that time, pills were expensive.
Yeah.
So. Evidence.
So the one thing, like, when I was in warrants, like, there was no, like, stealing drugs from people. And, like, I wasn't, like, arresting somebody for having, like, 10 blues, like, Oxycontin on them and, like, logging 8 in evidence and pocket. Like, it was none of that. But, like, I had a script for Percocet. And then, like, one of the guys that I was hanging out with, like, had a connection for a girl who had a script.
Oh, very nice.
So I was like, not
made it easy.
Yeah, it's like not hard to do. Nor is it hard to get a prescription for Percocet either.
Now they have it on lockdown.
Yeah.
Right. You can't like doctor shop or anything, but like you can still like go and get a script for Percocet, like 5 milligram Percocet. I'm sure it's not an issue.
How much responsibility do you think should be put on doctors who overprescribe this stuff? And I had that because for a short time, and I know the feeling of being hooked on those pills, because when I had shoulder surgery, the doctor gave me hydromorphine, and he said, take it every 4 hours as needed, and I just watched TV all day. It was awful. And then it was oxycodone, and he just take it as directed. And I did. I followed the one time in my life I followed directions.
You're going to withdraw like a
yeah.
Then if you're following the directions.
I'm following directions as he told me, as it's on the pill. So one, my shoulder's getting better and I know I got to go back to work. So I said, you know what? I got to stop this. I got to get off this stuff. I lay down at night and it feels like my skin's crawling. I go, okay, now I know what heroin withdrawals feel like.
Yeah.
To a lesser degree.
Right.
The only thing that got me through it was sleeping pills. I had a prescription for Sonata.
Okay.
And that was the only thing that got me through it.
And that's where the spiraling starts. You're replacing one pill for another pill.
Exactly.
And I was able to kick it, but it was a good 3 days before I was comfortable enough just to lay down with some peace.
Thank God, knock on wood, I never went through like any withdrawal or anything like that. Like I said, I was good at walking that line. So Thank God I never had to go through anything like that, because that sucks. But like as far as like how much responsibility like should be put on doctors, I honestly think it depends. Like, look, back in the day, like there were doctors just prescribing like 90 blues to like every Joe Schmo who walked in his office that was paying cash, you know, and that person was going to another dirty doctor. Like,
well, they also don't understand the dangers of law enforcement prescribing that, because that same doctor who kept prescribing me for 3 months, kept prescribing me, tried to send me back to work while I was under active prescription.
Yeah.
I go, are you out of your mind? Yeah. I said, you understand I carry a gun, I answer 911 calls, and I drive a car. How am I going to take it as prescribed? You keep prescribing this shit to me.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was workers' comp.
Well, that's why, like, look, like, in my opinion, like, there's not enough, like, emphasis on, like, physical and mental health in, like, you know, when it comes to doctors. Like, here's a pill for this, here's a pill for that. You know what I mean?
That's all it is.
And maybe, like, exactly. Some physical and mental, like, self-care, like, might be able to nip some of these issues in the butt.
But it's always been this way. Listen to the Rolling Stones.
Big Pharma.
Yeah, Mother's Little Helper.
Yeah.
You know, that was, what was the pill that they used to give her? It was like a Xanax or something.
Big Pharma, like, runs everything now.
Yeah.
You know, and as long as they're making money, the politicians are making money, and everybody's making money, and the doctors are making money, and everybody's happy.
Yep. So those pills, when they originally came out, oxycodones, the pharmacy said that only 1% of the people were ever going to become addicted to it.
Yeah.
That's out there. Listen, don't take my word for it. Do your own research. That's what they said.
Right.
How crazy is that?
It's insane.
Well, the way they prescribe them, 1% probably won't get addicted to it.
Here, maybe that's true because everyone's just going to graduate from painkillers to heroin.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. Andrew Tesler.
Yeah.
That's how he found his way to heroin. Upper middle class family, started on the pain pills. Pain pills got too expensive, graduated to heroin.
So that's like the telltale story for guys who we were arresting on in warrants. You know, guys on drug court. How did you get here? I had an accident. I got prescribed painkillers, and then I never got off. And I couldn't afford painkillers because painkillers are $1 a milligram, $30 for one pill.
Yeah.
So now I have to go buy a bundle of dope.
Couldn't get the Percocet anymore, so I had to go get heroin. And
yep, and here I am now, a mess.
And until they shoot it, they still think that they don't have a problem.
Right.
Once that goes into the vein, then all of a sudden
I'm just snorting. I'm not booting it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So you said there was a moment when you really got jammed up.
Yeah.
What? Tell us about that.
So I get kicked. So like the IA for that last off-duty incident that happens in January 2020, IA comes out for that. I'm in warrants at that time, and I don't get pulled out of warrants. Like, I know eventually, like, I'm gonna get pulled out of warrants for this, like, it was bad, but like, they kept me in there for a while. They pulled me out in June, maybe, like, towards the end of June, they pulled me out of warrants and they kicked me back to courts. I spend like 2 weeks in courts, and I get called in on one of my days off to come in and see the sheriff, and I know exactly what it's about. So they take my gun, they take my badge, and they say, you know, you're under investigation by the prosecutor's office. We'll be in touch, pretty much. They drug test me, and that was it. So, like, how I knew, like, I was eventually going to be getting called in, I get called in on, like, a Wednesday. The Friday before, shitstorm starts coming down, and one or two guys end up getting called in who I hang out with for a random drug test. One guy kind of sees the light and just goes and takes the drug test because he's going to start getting his shit together. So he just goes in knowing he's going to fail. And then another guy goes down to Florida.
Did somebody rat you out?
So one guy got caught being somewhere he wasn't supposed to be. And then like just things just snowballed downhill from there. Somebody ends up getting pulled over. They end up not like in my circle, but like another guy ends up getting pulled over. They bring him into the station. He signs consent to give up his phone. And then they just start, the prosecutor's office just starts flipping through his phone. We all end up getting called in. There's like a total 8 of us, I think, end up getting called in and getting suspended with pay. So they take our badge and guns, whatever. And then 5 end up. Yeah, 5 end up getting arrested. So me and 4 other guys.
So you got booked, charged.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So we ended up, obviously, like, I lawyer up right away once I find out, once I have an idea. And, like, mind you, like, this whole time, like, in July when this happens, I get called in. I don't know how bad, like, it is.
You don't know how much they know.
I don't know how much they know because, like, in my head, like, I was in this kid's phone. I didn't think, like, this whole time, I didn't think I was in his phone. Like, I was trying to, like, when everything happened, I'm like, how, like, did they, like, his what
phone,
happened?
His phone for what? What were pictures? Were there pictures?
Text messages.
Just text messages.
Text messages. But, like, in my head, I'm like, I'm not in this guy's phone. Like, I've never texted this person. Like, how am I involved? And I'm thinking, I, like, legitimately thought it was because I was with one of the guys before he went down to rehab to Florida. I was with him, like, for 2 days before he went down. Like, I was trying to, like, help him out. I was telling him, like, look, I'll fly down with you, like, if you want to go, like, whatever, you know. So that's how I thought I was, like, legitimately, like, getting in trouble for, because, like, I was with him before he kind of skipped out on his drug test. Turns out, like, they knew more than I thought they knew, obviously. But I don't know that until, like, I end up getting called into the prosecutor's office with my lawyer, and then they throw, like, the evidence at me. And then I'm like, I'm screwed.
Yeah.
Now you know you're screwed. And was it a come-to-Jesus moment?
Not yet. So I stopped the pills and everything, like, in the beginning of, like, September-ish. I'm like, all right. And I started seeing a therapist. So when I get suspended, start realizing, like, things could be bad. I don't, like I said, I don't know how bad they are, but, like, I know that they could be bad. I'm going to lose my job. So I started seeing a therapist, which is something that, like, people in my life were, like, were begging me to do. And I was like, no, I'm not going to see a therapist.
You're Joe Tough Cop, man. You don't need a therapist.
I got everything under control.
I got it.
Superman syndrome.
Yeah.
You know, I can do anything.
Super bed syndrome.
Yeah. So I start seeing a therapist. And this is like prime COVID too. So one of my buddies had seen a therapist, not a cop. So I'm like, give me her number. Like, let me give her a call. So I have like 1 or 2 sessions with her. You know, I explain kind of the situation. I explain I'm a cop, whatever. And she's like, yeah, you know, like, I have experience with law enforcement. Like, you know, I understand the culture and everything like that. But, like, as I'm talking to her, like, I could tell, like, you don't understand the culture of what it is to be a cop. You know, so I stopped seeing her. So then when one of the guys comes back from rehab, I want to start seeing a therapist again. Like, I had gone like a month or so without a therapist. And I'm like, the longer I'm suspended, the worse I'm pretty sure it's going to be. So I want to start seeing a therapist again. So he told me that the therapist that he had like in his IOP was pretty cool. So I'm like, do you mind if like I have her number? So he gives me her number. I talk with her, you know, she like doesn't see any conflict with anything because I know like somebody in her group. So I start seeing her and she's aces and I still see her today. And this is where like, I kind of like start toying with the idea of getting sober, like completely from alcohol. And I started toying it with her because I, like I said, I had stopped the pills like on my own. But I was still drinking throughout everything.
Something people don't realize is when you're drinking, your decision-making process, while you think it is perfectly sound,
so bad.
It is far from sound.
So bad.
You just, your decisions are, and you look back under through sober eyes, if you're lucky enough to get sober, and go, God damn, why couldn't I see that? Everybody else around you probably saw it.
Well, everybody notices it but you.
Yeah. Everybody. And problem is, like, nobody wants to say anything either, you know? Because it's a tough, like, conversation to have with somebody.
Right.
You know, I just had it with somebody recently. Not a cop, just, you know, somebody. And the conversation went well, but, like, it's very hard to, like, look somebody in the eye and be like, you have a problem. Like, you're an alcoholic. Like, I know it. Everybody else around you knows it. You're probably the only one that doesn't realize it.
Best hidden secret around is what it is.
Yeah.
It's best hidden secret.
It's best hidden secret in your own brain.
So the hammer drops.
Yep. I get called in at like the end of September. I realize that like everything is completely screwed. They're saying that I got to plead guilty to third degree conspiracy to possess, 3 years probation. If I fight it, they're going to charge me with official misconduct, which is a five flat if I go to trial and I lose. I'm like, well, that's like not an option. I'm not going to prison for 5 years for this. So I plea. I end up pleading on October 7th, I think it is.
That's my son's birthday.
I pleaded the worst day of my life.
Give it 5 more years, it'll probably be the worst part.
So I take the plea. I plea. 2 days later, I start my sobriety journey. I'm out with one of my friends who I worked with. He asked me to go out just to make sure I was okay. Because this was like public. Like, we were in the paper. Guys who I worked with, like, at this time, like, video court was like the thing because of the COVID. So, like, people were like eating popcorn, like getting off to like the worst day of our life. Like, guys we worked with, you know what I mean? So he calls me, wants to make sure I'm good. So we go out to ShopRite and I sit down and I, you know, the usual, like, give me a Blue Moon, give me a shot of Jameson. And I like drink the Blue Moon and I like go to take the shot and I'm like, no. So I like push shot away. And that Blue Moon was the last drink I've had, October 9th, 2020.
Why?
So I started going to Bottles and Badges meetings, which is an AA support group for first responders. Yeah. And I had been to a couple of them. And actually, no, I lied. The first one I ever went to was the Tuesday before I pled guilty, the day before I pled guilty. Something must have stuck in there with me because, like, the theme of, like, these meetings is, like, my life gets got so much better when I stopped drinking. It's the best thing ever. Not drinking has made my life so much better. And, like, mind you, like, the first time, like, that first meeting that I went to, like, I had a glass of wine behind my computer as I was on this meeting. And I didn't drink the wine. And I ended up pouring that glass of wine out after the meeting. Something like that must have stuck. And especially because the first person who I called after I pled guilty was the first guy that I met in the meeting, a guy named Dave. He was my first phone call after I pled guilty because I had kind of spoken to him, gave him like the rundown of like, I'm not a cop anymore, or at least I'm not going to be a cop tomorrow anymore. So he's like, call me right after tomorrow. I want to make sure you're good. So like, he was like one of the first phone calls I had made. And I guess like something stuck with me because I'm like, let me start to see like if being sober is like all that worth it. And like, I started, like, how I got started with it is there's a program run by this guy, Andy Frisella, who owns a supplement company called First Form. And it's called 75 Hard. And you have to do like, I think it's like 5 or 6 tasks a day for 75 days. It's like workout twice a day, one workout outside, drink a gallon of water, read 10 pages of like a self-help, like positive book, do one more thing and don't drink for 75 days.
So I start like a good program.
So I start doing this program, but I fail like after like, you know, a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, I ended up like, you know, not doing something. So I'd fail. But the one thing that I kept doing every single day is not drinking. So as this is happening, I'm still going to these online AA meetings. I'm still in therapy and I'm starting to see that, holy shit, like my life is getting better.
Things are getting clearer.
Things are getting clearer. I look better. I feel better. My relationships around me, for the most part, are getting better. Mind you, like I...
So you didn't fail?
No. That's a good way to look at it.
You did not fail.
No, that program, attempting to do that full program, turned my life around.
Because I think that program is set up. The other stuff is the hard stuff. The not... drinking stuff is actually the easy stuff because you just don't, you're doing something and you don't have to do something.
Right. It's really a diversion from drinking it.
That's it.
It's actually a very good way to put it because like one thing that you have to do in it is take a progress picture every single day. And that was something I was also doing. And mind you, like I've always been into working out, like physical fitness is a very big part of my life.
Well, before you took the progress picture, you should have manscaped.
I heard good things about Manscaped.
Manscaped. I mean, they became one of our sponsors. TSP is a 20% discount. You can go to manscaped.com. That would have been better, but I'm assuming you weren't supposed to be fully nude. I would have taken a progress pictures fully nude.
Shirtless.
Bottomless, too. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
It's all the same. You could use the
body trimmer.
The lawnmower?
Yeah,
the lawnmower. Yeah. You could
use a lawnmower to take care of your ceramic chest hair and all that stuff.
I'll tell you, I'm looking forward to the ceramic blade because the nips.
The nipples, yeah.
Ooh. It's sensitive, yeah. Ooh. You don't want to cut those.
No.
As I'm taking these progress pictures, too, I'm noticing, like, my body's changing. It but like my training is the same. You know what I mean? Like my eating for the most part is the same. But like I noticed, like I look back on pictures when I was like in my like prime of drinking, and like my face is so fat and so bloated, and like my whole body is just like
bloated. Yeah.
Bloated ball of water.
Like you're retaining water. Yeah.
So much. And I was like, I look back and I'm like, I thought I looked good there. Like, and I compare pictures of now, not a balloon of water and sweating out booze every single day. And I just like, I don't see a reason to go back to drinking. You know, like there's just all the talk about like your life is going to get substantially better. It's not bullshit. Like for me, it's like, it was really true.
There's two questions. First question I have for you, what is so different now? You said you had moments of sobriety in the past.
Right.
You thought you had it beat. What's different about now than then?
The biggest factor? There's a 2-year-old.
No, give me the smallest one.
There's a, whatever you want. There's a 2-year-old that like relies on me.
Okay. Oh, there you go. It's,
you know what?
That'll do it.
Yeah. That's fine.
You know.
You can usually pick them up right on the street corner too.
And, and I'm so thankful that hopefully this guy will never see me drink.
Mm. Mm.
And I know you should never say never, but.
They mimic your behavior, man.
It is insane. Yeah. And it's funny because like, so I drink like a ton of seltzer.
That's my go-to seltzer. I love seltzer.
And I'm just thinking about this now, actually, because it's true. He goes in the fridge and he gets a seltzer and he says, daddy, if I was drinking, he'd be going to grab a Blue Moon and saying, daddy, that's like not the image I want to see, you know?
When I was smoking, and I've been off smoking for quite some time, I never smoked around my kids because that fear. But I knew one day I would either have to quit because they're going to smell it. You know, they're too young to know when they're little. But that was always my fear with smoking. And thankfully, by the time they got old enough, I was clear of it. But the kids are just their minds. That's all they are. They just will mimic your behavior.
It's insane. But you know, we talk about it all the time, though. Addiction. When you give up something, it clears up so much room in your head.
Yeah.
You know, because you're thinking about, when am I going to get my next drink? Now you don't have to think about that. That leaves more room in your brain to start thinking about other things.
And there's a lot in my brain that I have to think about because I'm in grad school full time right now.
Well, so that was my second question. That actually leads into my second question. And I
that's why I did it. Just, they call that a segue.
It's a nice segue. And that's not that two-wheeled bike that you get on. Because I've never asked a cop who lost their job this question. The day you lose your job, you got to be sitting there going, fuck, this was my career. What the fuck do I do now?
What the fuck am I going to do?
Yeah. What's next?
So I was very lucky because one of my friends owned a moving company. So like as this is going on and I lose my job, I'm thinking, what am I going to do? Like I was applying to.
And you were how old when you lost your job?
31.
You young man.
30. You, 30. I just turned 31 right after.
Because Mike and I both, I'm significantly younger than Mike. Just, I want to point that out. I retired when I was 39 going,
what?
What the fuck do I do now? And the pension had nothing to do with it.
Right.
I got my pension. It had nothing to do with it. I'm like, what the fuck do I do now?
What do you do?
Because, again, you don't want to get into that same situation that you were in with the courts where you have no purpose.
Yep. So, for me, like, I was applying. Like, obviously, I'm like, I need a job. I just need to get an income. You know, like, I was lucky that I was getting paid when I was suspended. But now I'm like, well, now I'm not getting paid anymore. Like, what am I going to do? So, like, I was applying to, like, UPS. I was applying to, like, the, like, third-party, like, Amazon companies to drive trucks and drop off Amazon packages. And, like, I couldn't get a job because I was, like, I was looking after the background.
Well, you're convicted of?
I'm a felon. I'm a third-degree felon.
You're a convicted felon.
Correct.
So that you got to put that on the job application.
Yes. Yeah, so, like, that pops in a background check.
Yeah.
And, like, mind you, it's, like, a week old.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
It's still in the news, pretty much.
Yeah, like, if you Google my name, like, it's going to come up with four other people who, like, have their pictures when they got hired, and it says, like, arrested with some stupid, catchy little head title.
With the flag behind you and everything else. You know, regular police pictures.
Drug cops get arrested.
With a catchy title that wasn't even close to true, but whatever.
Media sensationalism.
Yeah. So, once, like, I'm like, all right, like, this is actually going to be an issue. Like, I don't think I'm going to be able to get a job here. I reached out to one of my friends who owned a moving company, and he's like, yeah, sure, come. So, like, I started working with him, and I still work for them.
Yeah.
Thank God. Like, very grateful to that guy and like his partners. Optimum Moving, plug. If you need to go move, call Optimum Moving.
We'll put a little lower third. Actually, you know, because I'm always appreciative of people who give somebody a second chance.
Yeah.
You trip, you fall, but you got to get back up.
Yeah.
And some people got to take a chance. They got to take a gamble on you because they don't know whether you're through your shit yet. They don't know whether you're going to fall back into your bad behavior.
Yeah.
So, you know, those people, and sometimes they get burned.
Oh, yeah, all the time.
But anybody who's willing to take a chance and there's a success story like that, I'm all in, man. Yep. I'm all for it.
So I'm working for the moving company, but, like, obviously, like, in my head, I'm like, I can't, like, work for a moving company forever. Like, this is not my career. This isn't the end goal for me. So I was looking to get into unions, like other unions. Like, one of my buddies' dad was retired from the Pipefitters Union, so he tells me to take the test. All right. Where were you?
274.
Yeah. Okay. The Parsippany?
Yeah. They were in Ridgefield when I was there.
So that's the one that I applied to, where he's like, just take the test, get in, you're good. Like, all right, great. I took the test and everything. I did the interview. Like, I didn't get in. So I was like, shit. And, like, mind you, like, this whole time, like, he's pumping me up. He's like, you're going to get it. You're good. It's like, in my therapy, like, I'm talking about, like, do I take it? Do I not? Like, I'm not love it. I don't love it. Whatever. I don't end up getting it. So I'm crushed. Mm-hmm. So I go back to the moving gig, and then one of my buddies works for the Iron Workers Union, Local 71, whatever it is. And, so he's like, why don't, and he knows, you know, the history of everything. He's like, why don't you just apply here? And I'm like, there's so much like nepotism and like, I'm never going to get in. He's like, dude, just apply. He's like, you're an athlete. Like, you're fit. Like, they're going to love it. He's like, you got a good story to go with it. Like, in your interview, he's like, go for it. So I'm like, all right, fine. So I go ahead and I do it. And the same time, I apply to grad school. I don't think I'm going to get in either because my GPA from my undergrad was like a 2.6. But I had some graduate courses when I was working with the sheriff's office because they would pay for your master's. So like a year before I got jammed up, I went back to get my master's in criminal justice. Stopped going when I realized I was losing my job. But so I had some master's courses under my belt that like made up for the GPA, the crap GPA in my undergrad. So I ended up getting into both. And
so you got into Iron Workers.
I got accepted into Iron Workers. Yeah. Very nice. Like, so like now everything that I lost, my pension, my good pay, my benefits, everything was just handed back to me. And it's crazy because I did the math on how long it would take me to hit top pay in the Iron Workers Union. I would have hit top pay faster starting in the Iron Workers Union when I did than had I just stayed on my path with the sheriff's office.
Because they moved it like a 15-step program.
Like their top pay in the Iron Workers Union was quicker to the top than it would have been had I just never gotten jammed up.
And you also do a lot of work with a good friend of ours, Frank Voci.
Yes.
I rep for responders. Frank's been on the show. He's a friend of the show, and I really admire what they're doing.
And he is a major part of my recovery and my journey.
Well, he's given you purpose.
Yes.
He's given you purpose.
So I found out about them in February, like right before I get sentenced. I reach out to Frank, and my therapist had turned me on to them. So I reach out to him. I shoot him a DM on Instagram, and I'm like, hey, man. I'm like, here's my story. Like, used to be a cop. I'm not a cop anymore, but I need some help. Like, I need some support.
Well, if there's anybody who will understand that, it's Frank because
he's got his own stories, he's got his own journey. Story,
yeah. Been there, done that.
Yep. So he says, come on in. He's like, you're just retired early, in my opinion. So I started getting involved with them and I go to their meetings. They run Sunday nights on Zoom, 7 p.m. Eastern time.
Was there any animosity towards going back into a law enforcement field?
I get this, like, I've gotten this question a few times, like, why are you, like, still, like...
You're still trying to hold on.
Yeah. So, no, like, I was never, and I really don't care what anybody thinks about it either. Like, you could call me a whacker, you can call whatever you want to call me, I don't give a shit. Frank and Reps Responders has given me a ton of purpose, because when I got involved with them, I was more mad and angry that, like, I don't know if those are the right words to use, but that, like, no one ever, like, said anything or, like, tried, you know, look, I'm a big boy. Like, I made my bed. I lied in it. I had to dig myself out. But, like, there were writings on the wall that, like, this kid is, like, not okay. Like, he's, like, pushing the limits way too much. If you didn't know that, like, I was drinking, like, excessively, like, you're literally the worst cop in the world. You have no business having a badge and gun if you couldn't figure out, like, what my group of friends was doing. And everybody did, because, like, there were nicknames for us, like, at work that, like, pretty much describe what we were doing. And everybody just turned a blind eye to it. So when I found out, like, what Reps for Responders was doing and, like, how Frank was, like, trying to help cops with, like, you know, substance abuse issues, I'm like, I don't want any cop to go through what I had to go through. Like, I thought what I, me and, like, the guys who I got jammed up with, I thought that sucked. Because it could have been something that could have been avoided. And everybody just turned a blind eye to it. And I, look, I didn't take the responsibility to get myself the help that I needed either. Again, like, everything is on me. But it could have been avoided. So when I heard, like, what he was doing, and when I started getting involved and I started going to the meetings and I started going to the events that he was running, I'm like, I really want to help out. Like, I don't want, like I said, I don't want cops or any first responder to have to go through what I went through, because it sucked. So that's why I'm involved. Like, I don't, like, I legitimately don't want to see guys get jammed up.
Now, if you had the chance to speak to someone, either yourself, your younger self, or somebody like you in the Reps for Responders world, and you see them going, you see it, you know, you see the signs, and now you have that burden of knowledge, what kind of advice do you give them now from what you've learned?
People need to learn that it's, oh, like, no matter what position you hold, like, there's no shame in asking for help. And that, I think, is the biggest reason why people don't ask for help, is because they're ashamed, they're embarrassed, they don't want people to know their dirt, even though everybody...
Embarrassment is a big part.
Yeah. You know? Like, they don't want people to know their dirt, even though everybody already does know. So they just think that they can handle it themselves or just ignore it completely, you know? And
it's
that...
shame.
I mean, that was it with me. Like, I look, you don't think I knew, like, doing drugs was bad? You know what I mean?
You, like, learned it in the academy.
You don't think I knew, like, drinking and driving was, like, incredibly dangerous? No, but I was also getting off on the adrenaline rush of doing it. I tell people, like, I got more of an adrenaline rush buying drugs than I did from doing them. Like, there's pills scattered out in Morris County because, like, I was just like, all right, like, I'm done with this. And I would chuck them out the window. You know what I mean? Like, but I got the adrenaline rush on a high from buying them.
Some toad is belly up on the side of the road. But, you know, I just spoke with a kid who's going into rehab. I just spoke with him today, as a matter of fact. And you could see the shame. And I said, look, bro, there's no shame. Okay. When you go in there, here's what's going to happen to you. They're going to strip you naked. They're going to make you bend over and they're going to check your brown eye. Make it talk.
Yeah.
Make it talk. Own it.
Hopefully they used Manscaped before they went in there.
But, no, keep it extra hairy so they got to look at that shit.
But you know what? Like, you'll realize that you're not alone.
No. Yeah.
There's so many more people who have the same issues, if not more forked up ones or less, but it doesn't matter because your issues are your issues. You know what I mean? It doesn't matter what other people have going on. Like, just because you think somebody has it worse, like, that doesn't mean that what you're going through should be minimized.
Well, also that and some people who you think have it all together are just better at hiding it.
Exactly.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, so, like, there's this big community of sober people out there, I promise you, that are out there that want to help.
And went through the same shit that you did.
Yeah. And that's part of the reason why I've chosen to, like, be open and loud about, like, being a former cop, getting arrested, and being sober now. Because I want somebody to DM me or call me and be like, I heard you on so-and-so's podcast. Like, can I talk? Yeah. Like, can I pick your brain about something? Like, this is what I have going on. And it's happened before.
Yeah. Well, I can attest to what you're saying, because sober life is so much better than drunk life.
Yeah.
By far. The good things that you have coming your way will never come while you're under the influence.
No.
Never.
And I tell you what, like, do I wish I never got jammed up? Do I wish I, like, could have, like, gotten sober and been a cop? Yeah, because I would have been a good cop. But things played out the way they did, and I'm so thankful for it. Like I said, I'm in grad school now, going to school to be, you know, I'm going to be a therapist. I want to specialize in trauma, PTSD, substance abuse, addiction. Like, that's what I want. So I'm going to school, Rutgers graduate program, 2-year program. I'm a year in. I just finished up my second semester today. Tomorrow the semester ends. take some summer courses. In the fall, I start my practicum where I'll intern at a substance abuse facility. Next spring is full-blown internship. Boom, done with grad school. I start my career. Yep.
You do? Okay, good.
Yeah.
Good for you.
We can hook you up if you don't.
Yeah. I was lucky. So the school will place you, but they'll place you in like vocational, like rehabilitation stuff, like career counseling. So I went out and I made some phone calls and I was able to place myself at a substance abuse facility.
All right. If you ever need any help with getting in a place, we have some hooks in that,
appreciate that area. It.
Now, where can we find you?
So my Instagram handle is NickR_RFR4.
There'll be a link to it in the show notes as well.
Perfect. Yeah. And then also Reps for Responders is just at Reps for Responders.
Just look on our Instagram. It's there. You know, I like all that stuff.
Yep.
I do. So we're coming to the end of this thing, Nick. And I try to end the show the same way every time because there's always a lesson in suffering. You've gone through, I think, every cop's worst nightmare. And listen, every cop's first, there's two worst nightmares. Number one, not coming home. And the second one is losing your job. I think losing your job is worse than not coming home.
Because, and, if you don't come home, you don't know if you lost your job or not.
Exactly. So what do you think that's taught you?
Like I said before, like, it's okay to ask for help. Like, I've had to ask for more help. Like, when I started, when that first time that I asked for help, I thought it would be the last time that I had to ask for help. And then I realized that I had to ask for help again. And I had to ask for help again. But the more I started asking for help, the more comfortable I was. And the more I realized that it's okay, that if you can't handle something, like, raise your hand, reach out to somebody who's been through, who can help you out. Because no one cares. Like, no one cares. All people want to do, the people that are close to you, they just want to see you better. No one's going to care that you need help with something. That's it.
I think that's very well said.
You know, like, no one cares. Just work on yourself, get better, ask for help. If you think you need help, you need help.
You need help.
You need help.
Absolutely.
That's the lesson.
That's the vulnerability of life. Nick, I can't thank you so much for coming in here today, telling your story.
Dude, you're a good man. You really are.
I appreciate you guys having me on here.
And, you know, whether you're still an active law enforcement or not, you're always going to be in our circle.
Listen, you're always part of the Suffering Podcast family now, so.
I don't know whether you want that. That might not be what you wanted.
I'm so glad to be here now.
You may have lost the family that you wanted and gained the family that you didn't
you
want.
Don't want
or the family that I need.
Thank you so much for coming in.
Absolutely, guys. Thank you.
And that's going to do it for this episode of the Suffering Podcast. As always, let's think about all the stuff that we learned. No purpose can destroy your life. Hard decisions may save someone's life. You can justify almost anything. Perceived failure can be actually victory. There's no shame in asking for help, but most importantly, second chances are rare, but they're out there. And that's going to do it for this episode. Don't forget, you can get your free digital business card. Go to popple.com, get your digital business card, put in TSP20 for a 20% discount. Don't forget to visit manscaped.com, put in the code TSP for a 20% discount there. Follow us on all social media, LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, TikTok, Instagram. Follow Mike at Mike_Fillets. Follow me at Real Kevin Donaldson. And of course, follow the Suffering Podcast. And we'll see you on the next episode.